Hi, everyone. My name is Nick Cipriano. I'm the president and CEO of River Rock Mortgage Investment Corporation, and we have invited Ron Butler to be our first guest, who has Butler Mortgage, and he's been in the business a very long time, such as myself. And we're going to talk about what we think about the industry and some ideas and see how that goes. So my first question for you, Ron, you've been brokering a long time. You've seen the mortgage brokerage industry change dramatically over the several years you've been in it. What have you seen? What have some of the big changes you've seen?
The big changes that we've seen in terms of doing mortgage brokerages with banks and lending institutions is a degree of complexity in executing the mortgages that absolutely no one would have believed would exist 5 years ago. If you told someone 5 years ago that it would take 200 or 300 pages of documents to close a bank mortgage, no one would have believed you. Just absolutely no one. But in fact, if you have enough transfers of down payment today between accounts, you can easily get up to 150 pages just of bank documents. Not hard, happens, it does happen, it absolutely happens. So I would say for mortgage brokers who are dealing in the A space with traditional lenders like banks, monolines like First National and MCAP, that complexity has been the story of the last 5 years.
And what positive things have you think happened since you've been in the industry? What would you say positive has happened to the industry?
The only positive thing that's happened in our industry is the speed of technology. So technology makes us more efficient. It allows us to communicate with the clients more efficiently. It allows us to move documents more efficiently. It eliminates the need to meet with people, which, believe it or not, is an enormous labor cost, whether you're working for yourself or whether you have a team of people. It's a significant labor cost to spend time sitting with people. And we've effectively eliminated that, particularly in the time of COVID. We've more or less eliminated that scenario today. I would suggest to you that right now, 70% of all mortgages in this country are being funded with situations where people have never met. They've never met the mortgage producer, whether it's a bank officer or a mortgage broker. They've never seen them, unless it's a Zoom call. They've never met, they've never gone anywhere. They're funding $300,000, $400,000, $800,000 mortgages, sight unseen. And there is a level of efficiency that's gained from that particular situation. So that's a big help.
And what do you think has been the most negative thing that's happened over the last several years?
Well, probably the most negative thing in some locations in Canada, such as the GTA, most of Ontario, parts of British Columbia, now today in growing in Montreal and Quebec City, is that the price of houses in Canada is ridiculous. You know, you can say what you want, you can justify the prices in any way that you wish, but ridiculous is the only word that seems to be appropriate. You know, Nick, you and I remember back 25 years ago when there's some rundown bungalow in Scarborough, 900 square foot bungalow in Scarborough would sell for $289,000. And that's like 20 years ago. 20 years ago is not the Bronze Age. Okay, it's just 20 years ago. $289,000. So today, with minimal improvements to the property, just basically preventing it from falling down, we're looking at a $900,000 property. So that's all in the dirt. I mean, you know, if you're a real estate professional, you understand that the house is just something you can knock down, put up, live in, don't live in, renovate, don't renovate, but it's got a fixed cost associated with it. The mystery is in the land. Like, how in the world did the land go from a $75,000 value to a $600,000 value in 20 years? In a place that there are no executives want to live there, period. Okay, there aren't. And we can start talking about Moore Park, Lawrence Park. We can start talking about all those areas. And we can just even talk about why a two-story off the Danforth costs it's a two-story, but it's only on a 22.5-foot lot, mm-hmm. and somehow it's worth $1.3 million. Mm-hmm. Okay, and yet, if you're a very large person, you can reach across the house and touch each wall. Mm-hmm. The right word is ridiculous, because it's a pricing environment that is fed by financialization. And that leaves people vulnerable to something happening someday. I'm not talking today. I'm not talking next year. I'm not talking the year after that. Because God knows we've gone through a worldwide economic catastrophe and a plague. And all that's happened in Ontario is the prices have gone up 20%. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, we can move the chess pieces around and figure out exactly why that's happened. But really, it's a plague. And the prices are up 20%. You've got to question just how much our society, our culture, and our government's commitment is to high house prices in major cities in Canada if you want to logically think about what the future is for somebody who's 28 years old and might want to own a home someday. Mm-hmm. I think those are questions that should be asked, because they're seldom asked, except in kind of a general, young person bitchiness. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that it's real. And that 28-year-old is going to be 38 someday. And they're going to have a family. They're going to have kids. And how the hell are they going to manage a $2 million house?
Mm-hmm. I see it a bit differently. I think a few things have made it different. So, for example, when I bought my first house was 1987. I think my rate was 11.5%. And I remember a year later, my mortgage came up for maturity. And I had a bank mortgage. And I'll never forget it to this day. I can remember looking at the renewal agreement, 6 months, 1 year, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, 13% down every single number. And I had a bank mortgage, right? And I thought, oh my God, 13%. And I paid it, right? Now I look at rates. The other thing, the other component of that 13% is, on a 25-year AM, after 5 years, at the end of first 5 years, I paid virtually a couple of $100 off my principal. Mm-hmm. Today, at these rates, every mortgage payment you make, 52% comes off the principal. So people are creating wealth. The other factor is, the low rate environment's created helps people stretch it, number one. Number two, I think immigration has played a very big role in all of this. Also, the world's much smaller today than it was way back when, right? So I talk to people all the time coming from other countries, like from London, from Paris, and they say, oh my God, I can't believe how reasonable prices are here, which sounds ridiculous to us because we live here and we see these things. So I think there's a difference there. The other difference I've seen, and I saw it in year 2000, was there was a fundamental shift. Prior to 2000, and you asked people younger people, and you said, what's goal number one? Goal number one, buy a house. What's goal number two? Pay off that house. And in 2000, I found that there was a fundamental shift in mindset in people. You asked them goal number one, buy the house still. Goal number two, buy a nice car. Like, there wasn't paying off the house anymore. There was this view of mortgage debt is good debt, and I'm okay to live with it because it's a fact of life. And there was a fundamental mind shift. So because of that, you're seeing people move more frequently, right? Because they got a little bit of equity, they move, they take on a bit more debt. The other factor is, too, is you see couples both working, both having good jobs. Like, mm-hmm. my mother didn't work, most of my friends when I was a kid, moms didn't work. Now, mothers are working, but they've got just as good a job or better jobs than the husbands. So there's good revenue coming into these households to afford this. So I think there's a lot of different moving parts on this. And I always say, like, I'm a little bit harsher on stuff. I always say home ownership's a right. It's not a privilege. It's a privilege, not a right. So you know what? Like, I always look at the person. You got two people making $100,000 a year. One person saving, watching their dollars and wants to get into a house. The other person's, traveling, living large, buying nice clothes all the time, saving nothing. And you go 25 years ahead, this guy's got a house, paid off a big chunk of it. The other guy's got nothing. Well, that's just life. That's choices.
Yeah, there's no question that Canada, particularly Southern Ontario, has had the benefit of this vast increase in immigration, that's not going to change.
It's going to get more,
now,
if anything.
But stop
it's
now.
But the Liberal government's already said they want to ramp it up.
Not just they're going to ramp it up, but they have, what many of us don't know is that the consulates and embassies all over the world have continued processing resident applications. And as soon as travel starts up again, if it's logistically possible, we could have 400,000 people show up in 6 months. Mm-hmm. So yes, immigration.
And the immigrants that come to Canada today aren't like the immigrants when my family came, when I came to Canada in the 60s. These people come with lots of education and they come with money, right? Not like in the 50s and 60s where they didn't have much education or much money and they were just grinders. Right?
Actually, in a lot of ways, I prefer your parents' generation of immigrants. I prefer people who come here with limited means and desire to work. One of the problems that we have in Canada and that has grown in the last 20 years is in big cities is that people have come here to export capital from other countries. And we've ended up with empty condos, empty houses. We've ended up with, in my own neighborhood, 10,000 square foot homes with two very, very old Chinese people in them. Okay, these houses are paid for cash. But what that affects is, that's an effect on pricing. When you're exporting money out of a country because you're afraid of your government, whether it's Iran, whether it's China, any of these, some of these Gulf countries, when you want to export money out of a country to put it in a safety deposit box that you call a condo, or you call a single family detached in Oakville, you have an effect on our pricing of real estate that is not natural. It's not natural in any way. And it's also not reported. Because the reality is many of these people have sent their kids, their parents, or their nieces and nephews to Canada to get a PR card. And once you have a PR card, you can buy all the real estate you want and nobody recognizes it as a foreign purchase. But if we wanted to do some real heavy analysis in Richmond Hill and Markham, we might discover that 50% of the houses have been bought with money that never originated in Canada. Some people say that's a great thing. Oh, yeah,
creating
that helps.
Jobs,
great
jobs. Yeah.
Well, it brings, you know, as long as we keep renovating these houses, it's a good work for contractors. But what we're going to discover is that it's a point of pressure that creates higher and higher pricing. And eventually you end up like San Francisco and you end up like New York, where you've got to have people drive an hour into the city to service rich people because they can't afford to live there. And there's a certain amount of cultural and societal conflict that can develop from there. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing, and obviously
it's just a thing.
It's a thing. but what I'm also saying is that even though you're right, immigration is not going to stop here, mm-hmm. and nor should it. I mean, Your parents were immigrants. 3 out of 4 of my grandparents were immigrants. The idea that the idea that we should complain about immigration is ridiculous if almost all of us are second or third generation immigrants. It's senseless. It's ridiculous. You can't make a logical case for it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad that I got in, but screw all the rest of you, okay? That's absolutely senseless, and everybody who says that should think twice. It's a version of Trumpism, and mm-hmm. it shouldn't be something that's part of the Canadian fabric.
So on the lender channel, you just kind of touched on it now. What other things from the lender side of things? Do you see any? What positive things have you seen happen over the years?
Well, in the very recent past, we've seen some positive developments on the bank side of the business. Nick, you'll recall that you and I went through a stage about a decade ago where banks exited the business. CIBC exited the business. BMO exited the business. It was HSBC exited the business, Tangerine disappeared, which was at the time, ING disappeared, sold to Scotia, disappeared on the mortgage side. So the mortgage brokers channel went through a time where there was fewer and fewer bank lenders. Suddenly, and National Bank left. Suddenly, there's a renaissance. TD, who has stayed in our channel, albeit in a way that sort of vacillates between aggressive and not aggressive, has suddenly decided they want to be very aggressive again. They are delivering mortgage rates on big mortgages, $1 million plus mortgages, that are as good as anything that a bank branch offers. We've got HSBC coming back into the channel. They'll be back in by 2021. We've got National Bank has come back to the broker channel in the province of Quebec, may go wide next year, the year after. So we're seeing a kind of an interest. When I talk to the executives at these companies, their comment to me is this: although the mortgage brokerage channel is a very expensive channel to run, it is a very expensive acquisition cost to bring in a mortgage, the beauty of it is it's unbelievably efficient. If you offer a rate, you get business, and you get it in quantity, and you get some quality business out of that, and you get some new customers, because what banks have discovered is their branch systems cannot generate a new mortgage customer. They just can't. COVID was the stake through the heart of it, but they can't generate new business. They can handle some renewal business. If somebody comes in and wants to add a line of credit, they can do that. But to find fresh mortgage customers, only a bank sales force or a mortgage broker can accomplish that. Mm-hmm. And banks' experimentation with digital, and some are doing it in a real way, has not had the effects, not had the breakthrough effects that they've been looking for. Mm-hmm. So I would say that in particular in the last three years, we've seen a kind of renaissance of banks returning to our channel. And that's only good because, as Nick knows, because he was a banker for many years, more is better. Mm-hmm. Few, not as good. Mm-hmm. So that's a positive that we see.
And what about on the negative side from the lender perspective?
It's always the same set of difficulties. It's complexity. We've got regulators on all sides, whether it's provincial regulator less, but certainly the federal regulator of the banks and the insurers more, who simply have no reason not to keep layering on new things. Let's face it, they're a regulator. Nobody can say no, right?
Right.
Their leaders in government don't say no. Their leaders in government just says, oh, you want to be more careful? Go ahead, be more careful. Mm-hmm. To the point where the best example? The best example is that in Canada, we still take an 84-year-old granny, if she's randomly selected, we're going to put her through the screening at the airport where we're going to, run a wand over her dress, and, she's 84, and we don't think she's that dangerous, but this is our country. This is how we do it. We treat everyone the same. A lot smarter in Israel, where they just try to figure out who they start tracking the people driving to the airport through cameras and try to decide who the possible dangerous people are there. But we don't do that in Canada. So we do the same thing with our AML. And AML is probably becoming the biggest swamp in the A mortgage business, is money, anti-money laundering. So it's being applied to people who obviously are not laundering money, but we're going to apply the same rules to everyone. In the meantime, the people who don't qualify because they probably are laundering money, they're just going to a private mortgage anyway. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we are layering on and absolutely frustrating our customers, the consumer, the mortgage consumer, because they don't understand. I mean, I did deposit that $3,800. Well, what is it? Like, we won some money at the casino. I don't mm-hmm. even want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Nope, you're going to have to, get some video of you at the casino. You're going to have to back that up. I mean, you've got to be somewhere. You got to prove that you took money out the previous times, and then you won. And this is crazy. This makes no sense. Because people say, oh, no, AML starts at $10,000. No, AML does not start at $10,000. The regulator, OSFI, says, whatever is your judgment, whatever you think is unusual in a deposit, you should investigate. And we want you to investigate. And if we catch you not investigating, you're going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. So this has led to an incredibly complex integration of so much information that we have to bother the consumer for. And then again, when we go on the income side, if you have three part-time jobs, as you'll remember, Nick, from your banking days, we might even just say, you may have had these three part-time jobs for the last 3 years, but we think it's, you're going to get worn out, and we're not even going to count one of them anymore because we don't think somebody can stay with three part-time.
Work that many hours a day.
Exactly. So there's so many reasons today. I'll put it to you this way. When I started in this business, you could close a mortgage with somewhere between 9 and 16 pages of documents. That's all. That's all you had to ask the client for. Self-employed, employed on a salary, didn't matter. 16 documents tops. The 300 pages that I'm talking about is not impossible today. And it's very, very hard to explain that to a consumer. Like, virtually impossible.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't have to deal with that.
No, you don't.
And I never have my whole career, believe it or not, because I've always dealt with alternative lenders. And I was always, as the regulations changed, I always seemed to kind of move.
Yeah, I remember you introduced Accelerator. You had lots of rules about Accelerator.
Yeah, but that was a money-making opportunity because of bond shifting.
Absolutely.
That was all about bonds. Most people don't realize that.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, great.